I'm delighted to introduce Ian Flatt. My name is Adrian Wills. I'm one of the clinical leads for eBrain. And this is the second in a series of interviews that we've been having. And Ian is a 56-year-old man. He's married to Rachel. And he was diagnosed with motor neuron disease in 2019. And I'm really grateful to Ian for agreeing to this interview. What I'm going to do is talk to him a little bit about his background and then his experience of the illness, and then perhaps ask some other broader questions about his care, etc. So Ian, welcome. Thank you so much for agreeing to this.
Thank you.
I just wondered, you're 56, you're married to Rachel, you've got two daughters. I wonder if you could just tell me a little bit about your upbringing and your childhood, please.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, I'm one of three brothers. And my parents emigrated from Ireland in the 60s and brought us up over here. I was born over here in Yorkshire. And my mum became a single parent not long after I was born. And she has been the totem pole of our family and has kept us all together. And she's just an incredible lady. So she brought us up, looked after us and sent us to the right Catholic schools. And then eventually, rather curiously, in the mid-70s, mid-late 70s, she met my dad. I call him dad now. And she married him. He was a British policeman, which was challenging in the 70s with getting back to Ireland and one thing or another. But I'm glad to say he is an incredibly brilliant man, somebody I've always called him dad because I don't know anything else. And he's just a mum and dad now live in Canada. They retired there about 30 years ago. But yeah, they brought us up, looked after us, kept us fit, encouraged me. And I used to do a lot of cross-country running. I used to do a lot of sports, rugby union and football for the school. And they were always there encouraging us to do that. Mum was always and she teaches yoga now. She's 77 almost, always a fitness guru. And brought us up to the same. So we would do the Yorkshire Three Peaks before they were really famous as the Yorkshire Three Peaks. We would walk around the Yorkshire Dales and everything else. And we just brought up as an outdoors family.
Yeah. And were you and your brothers quite competitive?
Yes, particularly myself and the eldest is only 2 years between us. And Chris, the youngest, is 6 years. He's 6 years younger than me. So my eldest brother and I were very, very competitive. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And has that sharpened or mellowed with age?
Maybe mellowed over the last few years because I allow him to have his moments of glory now.
right. Yeah. And so tell us a little bit about what you did after school.
Well, I was incredibly fortunate. I guess all of us, if we meet people who have an impact on our life and I was sort of wandering around, not really knowing what I wanted to do, to be honest. I met a guy who taught me, trained me as a surveyor, a chap called Alan Furness, who was a senior officer in Leeds, in Leeds City Council. He'd come up through the sort of the local authority route. And he taught me so much, took me under his wing, sort of an estimator, a surveyor. I went back to college and did some work on that. And eventually I got to be a regional surveyor, I think by the time I was 25. And I couldn't settle so much. And I wanted to move to London. I'd moved around a little bit. And Alan helped me apply for a job in London. Oh, I think 92, 93. And I was fortunate to get that job, and I moved to London to take up a position there as a managing surveyor.
Yeah, and you told me previously that you were involved in contract law and things like that. And did you have some connection with 9/11 or other things that happened in London? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was a little bit later, obviously. I did. I mean, Alan had discovered this desire and this aptitude I had for contract law and for remembering, you know, I had a terrific memory for the nuances and the details of contracts. And he really exploited that and pushed me to get into that side of it, contract law, which I did. And I think I mentioned before, I was an expert witness in a number of cases, over 150 cases in total through the 90s. But yeah, after 9/11, I was approached by an American company to take over a project management for them to deliver infrastructure services for the United States forces here in the UK initially. So it was in respect, obviously some security issues, some of it about just improving the environment for the American service personnel that were in the UK, making life better for them and making some of their working areas a little bit more efficient. I remember walking into Menwith Hill and we had to go in down to where they were listening. They told me who they were listening to and who they were spying on. But the American GIs formed a corridor by holding up sort of A4 sheets. And we had to walk through, so everything was screened away from us.
Okay, right, wow. Yeah.
But it was fascinating time.
Yeah. And you also told me that, you know, after you lived in London, you moved to Devon and then you moved back to North Yorkshire. What was the, you know, what was the motivation? I mean, obviously they're very different places. What was the kind of motivation for that?
Yeah, well, Rachel and I were incredibly blessed to have two daughters, you know, Charlotte, who, funnily enough, is 21 tomorrow, and Ishmael. And I'd done the corporate thing and we were working hard in London. I was away a lot. I was looking after a portfolio of critical engineering projects for people like Royal Bank of Scotland, Deutsche Bank, London Stock Exchange, we worked for the Bank of England. We looked after the MI5 building, all sorts of different things. And it was full on. And we just decided to take a step back, move to the beach, and the girls learned to surf before they could ride a bike.
Yeah, wow. Sounds idyllic. Sounds yeah, great.
It was beautiful. But I took another project on, I guess, in 2008, 2009, which I was determined to stay locally, but my ambition got the better of me. And all of a sudden I was leaving Rachel again. I was wandering off all over the place to work. And our nearest neighbour, well, where we lived, it was quite remote in Devon. And Rach said one day to me, she said, I'd like to move back to Yorkshire, back home, back to friends.
Yeah.
And it worked with where the business was taking me. So that was that. We were delighted to come back. We loved North Yorkshire, but I do miss the sea. I've got to say that. I do miss the South Devon coast.
Yeah, yeah. And just going back to the sporting aspects, you said you played rugby. I mean, I think you also boxed as well. I mean, did you do sport to a fairly high level or?
I was never as good as I thought I was.
Right.
But unfortunately, I have a stubborn streak. So even when the chips were down and I should have thought twice about it, I still carried on and. I we've always had that built in, as I think we get that from Mo. But I remember the Three Peaks. I did the Three Peaks with some pals of mine who were marathon runners and one thing and another. And they suggested I should train. And I don't need to train. I'll turn up and I'll beat you anyway. And down the last peak, I raced them. I raced them down, and I was injured on the second peak, so I had two crutches. To walking sticks, if you like, and I raced them down there with one leg down the last peak. And it's just, I don't know, it's just, as I say, my mum brought us up. The rugby, I loved rugby. And I played that into my sort of mid-20s, I guess. Not very good, but always willing to participate. And I love just getting in the mix of it. And I love the physicality. And the same with fighting. I wasn't very good. But I just enjoy it. I just enjoyed that, I guess, that challenge, that battle, that sort of, sometimes, not conquering your fears, but the idea of of just seeing what you can do. And for me, I've always been intrigued, and even more so over the last 2 years, in what you can condition your brain to do, what you can condition it to, how you can condition yourself to get better, to push yourself further, to do something that people, you know, the best thing for me in my life is when people say to me, I can't do something.
Yeah, right. Okay. So, Ian, I want to move forward a bit now. I mean, I think in common with lots of other patients who ultimately turn out to be diagnosed with motor neurone disease, it took you a long time to get a diagnosis. I mean, can you just tell us a little bit about, you know, what you noticed and what kind of interactions you had with the medical profession, and any reflections now with the benefit of hindsight about how that worked out?
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, I'd go back, I'd introduce that by saying how, you know, I was fit. I didn't go working out every day, but I was very, very fit. And so rarely would go to the doctors. So I eventually went in December 2017. And it was just, well, I was losing strength in my hands. My grip wasn't there. Suddenly opening jars, for instance, was a bit more problematical than it ever had been. Now, so that must have been going on for quite a while to motivate me to go to the doctors. I wouldn't have just gone on a whim. And I think it was golfer's elbow or something similar that they came up with. And over the next 3 or 4 months, it was getting worse in so much that I was getting spasms in my wrist and my forearm on the right-hand side. And then by the April of 2018, it was affecting my, all of a sudden I started experiencing fatigue in a way that I never had before. I barely slept, Adrian. I mean, I thought sleeping was anathema. It was just such a wasted opportunity. So, you know, if I had 4 hours, that would be as much, Rach would have to fight me for me to go to bed. But then, you know, the minute the sun came up, I was out of bed again. I just hated sitting around, and all of a sudden I was getting up for work, having a shower, then going back to bed, shattered. Reasons where driving to the office, 45 minutes, I'd stop and have a sleep. And I'd pull off the motorway when I was out for meetings, and, you know, all of a sudden my days were broken up around where I could sit and sleep, where I could go for a nap. Can't remember the number of Tesco's and Asda car parks I found that I could go for a sleep in.
So you must have thought at that stage, you know, knowing yourself, that there was something seriously wrong with you. I mean, did you, were you able to get any hospital appointments? I mean, what was your experience of that, of secondary care? Or?
Well, I think through the sort of April to September, it was just blood tests and talking to my GP. They couldn't pinpoint anything. I had a succession of blood tests, it seemed, every week. And then eventually at the end of September, early October, and in this time I'd lost about a stone in weight over 3 months. I think I lost a stone and a half in total over during the year, but at this point I'd lost a stone. And they thought it could be cancer, so I was sent in fairly rapidly for cancer tests, and I had CT scans, I had MRIs over a period, a bit of everything, and obviously came back with negative on that, fortunately. And after that, it was my kidneys. They needed looking at, but it wasn't my kidneys. But also by this time, I was getting palpitations. What we now know was my respiratory system was beginning to be compromised. And I was building up. I couldn't expel the CO2, the carbon dioxide. We didn't know this at the time, but we know now. And so there was all sorts of heart scans, and once again more MRIs. I went through lots of different referrals in a short space of time between the October and December. I think I may have mentioned to you that I'd seen Doddy Weir at Murrayfield in the Autumn Internationals. And I'd always liked Doddy. I was a big rugby union fan, and as much as he's not Irish, I always liked him. Mm. And I don't know what made me do it, but I started doing some research. And at the end of December, I'd convinced myself that I had MND.
Right.
And
that must have, you must have felt, you know, I don't mean, well, perhaps a bit lonely or unsupported, because you'd made that sort of leap yourself. I mean, how did you, after that, how did you manage to engage the doctors to kind of get on the pitch, as it were?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the thing. Every time I went to the doctors through that long period, they're fabulous, great, you know, fabulous GP surgery. But it's just, and what I know now, how I reconcile it is, well, it's such a rare condition and there's such limited knowledge in general practice about the condition. You know, it wasn't for want of trying. They give me, as I said, every referral going, it seemed. But we were very fortunate that Rachel spoke to the GP surgery, and I'd not mentioned to Rachel what I thought I had. I just didn't discuss it. It's the same with when the cancer referrals came in, I didn't tell Rachel until I got the all clear. And I told her I'd been for a cancer referral retrospective. Yeah, yeah. So we went and we saw a different GP, a GP I'd seen years before, in the same practice. And when I walked in and talking to him, I knew he knew. And he went to say what his thoughts were, and I stopped him, because Rachel was with me on the appointment. I just said, no more guesswork. I don't want you to guess. I don't want you to say another word.
Yeah.
And he said to me, well, would you come back tomorrow? And I said, yes, I would. We'll do some tests. So I came back the next day on my own. And he did some tests. And by this time he'd taken my top off, he could see the the muscular waist on my arms. He could see the vacillation in the muscles. And it was pretty active at the time. And we referred me there and then.
Yeah. And I think, so after you were referred, presumably, but you know, the neurologist pretty soon cottoned on what was wrong. Just tell us about about what happened about the breathing side of things.
Yeah, well, as you said, within 10 minutes of seeing the neurologist, she confirmed it was motor neuron disease. And luckily, I got put straight into Dr. Jung in Leeds, into her team, under her care. And the first thing on seeing those guys, the first thing they did was put me in for into the respiratory team. And so within, I'd say, 2 weeks, 3 weeks at the most of diagnosis, I was issued with an NIV. The respiratory nurse come around the house, shows out, you know, we had it all installed, and dead easy to do, and that was that. But my fear, not fear, but my feeling at the time was, okay, well, from what I understand, the more I use this, the more I'll need it. So what's the minimum? And we're like, we'll use it overnight. So I thought, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to limit it to 3 or 4 hours and see how we go. But of course, that was just, eventually your body just tells you what it needs, and you have to do what your body needs.
Yeah.
But I was setting my
just own. Just for the listeners, I mean, just so that obviously they can't see you, but you're not using the machine at the moment. So off the machine now, do you feel okay? I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had a good top up today. I feel great. You know, you can see me. You can probably see that I do. There's an effort from time to time to breathe, and I sort of pull myself up a little bit as I'm taking the breaths. But I feel great. I feel great.
Yeah.
I
mean,
the NIV is brilliant. It just gives me so much energy, as well as the balance of keeping my oxygen and carbon levels in the right place.
Yeah. So again, just for the benefit of the listeners, it's quite obvious that you are using your accessory muscles to help you breathe. But you know, as you say, you're doing all right, I think.
No, absolutely. And I mean, we average at the moment now about, and it's a broad average. Over the week, it probably works out about 16 hours a day that I'm on it. Now, if tomorrow I do 10 hours, and I have a day out and we go and do lots of things, that's fine. I'm perfectly able to cope with that. It just means that the next day or perhaps the following day, I'll just top up and I may stay in bed all day and just get the balance back.
Yeah. So, as I said to you before, I Googled you before before doing this, and I can see that you've been very involved with, for instance, like the Rob Burrow Foundation, and you've done those series of treks. Yeah. I mean, you must be very proud of that, because I think you did, you raised, what was it, £17,000. You did over 20 trips. I mean, can you just tell us a bit about that?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, well, the first one that we did, I'd been planning for a long time, and I wanted to do in 2020, but of course with the pandemic and everything that was going on, it just wasn't possible to do what we needed. So, but it was a great comfort for me. I come into my office, be independent in here and plan these treks, research them. I'd ask friends to go out and double check there was no stiles or kissing gates on some of them. And it was a beautiful mental exercise. It was really, really helpful for me just to be able to plan these walks. And we interacted with the national parks and everybody else with lots of support. So the first one was in May and June we did. As you say, 20 walks. We did 116 miles, the target being 100, but we did 116 miles over the Yorkshire Dales in my off-road wheelchair. And we went to some fabulous, beautiful places and made lots of friends as the restrictions lifted. Lots of people came with us and supported us. And it was great fun. It was just great fun. But once again, it was, you know, people telling me, well, you won't get up that hill. There's no chance you'll get up there in a wheelchair.
And then you did.
Yeah, we did. It's like, really? So, and then speaking to Dr. Jung and her team, and Dr. Jung's vision and passion about the M&D Centre that she wants to build in West Yorkshire. I was really engaged with that. And in September, sort of thought, right, okay, I need to do something to help. And obviously inspired by Rob and Kevin Sinfield and everybody else that's been in that, I decided to do another 100 miles across the North Yorkshire Moors and across from the coast, which we did in October and November. And that was beautiful again. Different weather, different challenges, because the Moors are very different to the Dales. And once again, part of, I think, reconciling any illness, any limited condition that people have, is finding the ways you can win, finding the ways that you can get a bit of joy out of it every day. And one of the biggest wins for me, I'm left-handed and the controls on my wheelchair are obviously on the left-hand side. And my left arm stopped responding on one of the walks, and like, fine, okay, well, we need to practice on the right-hand side. And we put it on the right-hand side, and I think it was the next day or the day after, we did one of the toughest walks I've ever done, which was 1,000 feet climb up a place called Highcliffe Now. And we did it with my right arm, controlling the wheelchair. And it was brilliant. It was like, well, see, we can do it. We can do whatever we go back to, you know, what's in your brain and how you condition your brain to saying, well, we can do this.
Yeah, yeah.
We just find a different way of doing it.
Yeah. You also said, I think, in one of your blogs that if you're having a bad day or so, you know, things have not gone so well, that you like to listen to music. What are the tracks that you listen to kind of get you through, as it were?
There's a little bit of everything. I love listening to the Rolling Stones. I love listening to some of their live music. Yesterday it was Neil Diamond, curiously. I haven't listened to Neil Diamond in years, but yesterday it was Neil Diamond. And it's just, there's all sorts of different music, some Gaelic music that I love listening to. I obviously don't understand the words, I'm not a Gaelic speaker, but some of the music is beautiful. I understand the sentiments of what the songs are about. So it's a bit of everything, but a lot of blues, a lot of old soul music. You just come, you know, and I sit in this office sort of less so these days, but for that, when I've needed to reflect and I've needed to just think, okay, something's changing here, I need to get my head around it, I just come in the office and put my music on. And,
you know. I mean, again, just for the listeners, you've got some very quirky dancing elephants going on there behind you. So I've got two more questions really. I mean, one is can you just tell us a little bit about, have you, what's been the impact of COVID on you or on the, you know, have you noticed any difference? What's the?
Yeah, I think so. We're quite a private family up until doing these treks. I'd never really used social media outside of the business context. I'd never put anything on there. But what we've always enjoyed is socialising with our nearest and dearest and closest friends. And with the girls, our two daughters have always been part of that. And I think that as a family, we missed. We've had to, lots of things have been closed for a long time for all of us. But also we have to make some judicious choices in what I'm exposed to. So I think that's been a shame. It's been a shame for the girls. But on the other side of it, Adrian, we've sort of ignored it in a little while. We live in a small village, so we can get out and about. We can sit in the garden. We can do lots of things together. And in some ways, it's sort of melded us together as a family that we're a little bit more self-sufficient. I still have a Zoom call or a FaceTime with all my friends, and lots of us catch up through that medium, and we don't see as many people. But we seem to spend better time with the girls just as a foursome.
So my final question is, if you were to give any advice to someone who's just been diagnosed with motor neuron disease, what would that be?
I think the best advice I think that I could give somebody is just to live for now, live for the day you're in. There's lots of things you can and you may end up worrying about. Try and put those to one side and extract some joy, I like to call it quick wins. Get your wins for the day, get in front of the disease. And, it helps so much that Rachel and I have been at a plan a little bit. So we've always been ahead, we felt. We've never had a disaster where, oh, my God, I can't get up the stairs or whatever, you know. We've always been ahead of it. And that gives me so much satisfaction. I feel as I'm winning. And I think that's my advice to anybody, is find something that makes you happy. Find the stuff that you enjoy. And do that every day.
Right. Well, listen, that's really inspirational words, and I'm so grateful to you for giving up the time to do this interview. So Ian, thank you so much indeed. Thank you very much.
My absolute pleasure, Adrian.
Okay. Thank you.